But then you went on to New York for graduate studies.
Yes, but before that, I went, this OCU, this Inez Silberg, had me enter all these contests, national contests. She did that with all of her students. We became known around, especially around the tri-state, Texas and Oklahoma and Kansas. Her students were always winning these contests. So by the time I finished university, I won 30-some national contests and money and things. And the one that got me to opera was the one I won in San Francisco. It got me to San Francisco from Oklahoma. That's my jump. And I went to a program there, and it was very, you know, I was the youngest person in that program, 22 years old, because most of them were 27, 8, and they were really trying to launch their careers. And so I remember them discussing me, because I was the young, and they said, oh, she can't win, she's too young. And I won that whole thing, right? And they were just flabbergasted, but Kurt Adler chose me to be the winner, and that started my semi-professional that got me with San Francisco Spring Opera.
But you did go to the Juilliard School.
Yes,
in
that
New
was
York.
After that.
Oh, after
the
that.
Spring Opera.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
I went, and then I went to New York. I got a manager, Columbia artist, one of the top managers there. He'd heard me in Santa Fe. I'd done a program, an artist program, and won that. And he heard me in Santa Fe and took me on. And then that made me go to New York and audition for different things, different companies. And then I auditioned at Juilliard, and they wanted me bad. They actually, I didn't get in trouble, but it was awful. They already had a soprano doing that opera I had never done, La Boheme. And they heard my voice, and they said, we want her. And I tell you, they enrolled me in that Juilliard so that I could do that opera for them. And it was a huge success.
So that was scholarship, obviously, too, then.
No, it was really semi-professional, sort of. I had to be a student, but, you know, but it was a trade-off, actually. I got to go to that intense training there and then do that opera. Mm-hmm. And I made straight A's, right? But the young lady that was to do it, they pulled her off. It was really sad. But I had nothing to do with that. But they wanted me.
Off from where?
They pulled her off of the part that they gave me. She was already the soprano. Was supposed
but that's
to
at
be,
the Met,
no,
it?
No, this is in Juilliard. And so then they put me in it. Oh, my God. But I got all this New York Times publicity and from that. I mean, people paid to get that kind of publicity, but I got it.
Mm. You know, we've moved pretty fast through your career, but
it was fast.
Since you're African American, through all that up to here, was there prejudice?
Leontine kind of paved that way. She had just made her debut at the Met in 1965.
Price.
Yes, Leontine Price. She was a real, you know, like Marian Anderson did it, but it was like at the end of her career and just a few performances. But Leontine Price was the actual first black diva that was likened to the Collison, to all of those, that was allowed there. So that had opened the doors. And so by 75, when I came along, those doors were open.
Don't you think music and your voice breaks down those racial barriers?
Absolutely, but there were a lot of, there was a book written, I think her name is Rosalind, she was from Tulsa, about black sopranos and how even in the late 1800s there were black sopranos and they let them sing in Europe, but they couldn't sing in America. So it was a lot of great voices that, you know, even though they had the great voices, they couldn't come here. Yeah, it was one soprano, I can't remember her name, that was just before Leontine, and they were talking about her in New York, how fabulous she was, but Leontine was the one that got there. And she was right on the hills with Martin Luther, so it was like opened it. It opened it completely.
She's still living. She's
97.
97. Yeah, have you ever met her?
Have I ever met her? She kind of took me on. Yes.
Did she really?
Oh, yeah. She was so gracious and so wonderful. She would call me Miss Mitchell. Yes. So she had a talk with me, and we did all of that kind of stuff. Yeah.
And of course,
everybody's idol, all American, not just black, but she was an idol to many sopranos. Yeah, great soprano.
When, like, you're in Juilliard, and you other students were there.
Yes.
did you think that there were some there who were extraordinary,
yes,
but they dropped
were.
Out for some reason and they didn't?
Yes,
they
that
wanted.
Happened. So one went on, one tenor became famous. We were in the cast together, and one conductor, he became a very famous opera conductor. That was the conductor and the tenor from that production that I was in.
Mm-hmm.
His career was launched for all over Europe and everything. Neil Schickoff and the conductor, James Conlon, who runs the Los Angeles Opera now, he became famous and conducted everywhere. And one of the other parts, she was wonderful, but I don't know what happened.
Mm-hmm.
But she did. She ended up teaching, but she was lovely from there. So, yeah.
You know, you were in Santa Fe. You had an apprenticeship,
mm-hmm.
didn't you?
Yes,
in
I won an apprenticeship there. I won a contest.
I can relate to Santa Fe because my wife and I attended that beautiful outdoor venue for opera.
Isn't it wonderful?
It's beautiful.
It's so spectacular. It just transports you into another world just sitting in an audience, right?
And
you're outside.
I think you see mountains in the back there.
Yeah, it is so, yes.
And you sung on that stage.
Oh, yes. I was there as an apprentice, and then I came back and did as a artist. I did Donna Anna there in Santa Fe.
And then I liked because mm-hmm. they had the words in front of us.
Yeah, so you could, that was pre, now everybody does that, but see,
oh,
Santa
really?
Fe started that.
Is that right?
Yeah, but the Met, even they wouldn't do it for years, but now they do it. Yes.
Well, it brings in more people.
Yes, especially, you know, the American audiences don't speak all these languages.
No.
Yeah,
no.
So it's wonderful.
Right,
it's
right.
fabulous.
And then understanding it, so it brings people back.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a beautiful,
beautiful
venue. But Kurt Adler stayed with you. He was supportive
in many
areas.
He's one that I made a recording with, Kurt Adler. Yes, he was very instrumental in my beginning of my career. I would actually run things through him because I was so new. And I actually asked him about my future manager. And he says he hated managers because he was the intendant, so he was always wrangling with the manager. But he would tell me, I remember, I wish I'd kept that letter. He says, well, as far as managers go, I think he's a great manager. That killed him to say that. But yeah, so I felt, because it was a sea of nothing. I didn't know anything. So I didn't know what this manager meant. But yeah, so he said, yeah, you would do well going with him. And I did.
I'm thinking about your parents right now, and you're off in New York, and you're in your early 20s. Are they checking in
early
on you?
Early 20s.
Yeah.
Early
20s. Are they checking in on you? What's going on? Are they monitoring you?
Oh, gosh, yes. Yes, but I was married. I was married at the last year of my in my bachelor's, and my husband was killed a year later in a car accident.
Mm.
So
what was his name?
His name was Robert House. So I was Leona House. But because of that, I was a really mature young woman. And so they, you know, I was could take care of myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, but they would check on me. So
I'm sure.
I have a lovely story about my mom later on with she and Miss Preeby and vying for my attention because I was traveling 30 days a year and for 30 years and I was always gone. So it was precious when I could come home at some point and visit family. And so mom, she was always used to sharing me with everyone, you know. But this the one time I'd never seen my mother like that, but it was at the end. She said, well, I want to have my daughter. I want to be with my daughter myself. Do I have to? Can't you just be with me? And so she told Miss Preeby that. Miss Preeby said, okay, I'll back out. We don't have to have lunch today. Miss Mitchell, go ahead. But my mother, and then another cute story about my mom was, because I was very regimented when I sang, and I think that's what helped me have longevity. I learned that from Inez Silberg. I would start a regime where the night before I sang, I wouldn't use my voice. I would rest, you know, because operas are sung. If people don't know this, we sing to houses of 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people without microphones. So we have to have great strength, and you have to take care of that little instrument inside of you. You have to take care of it and take care of yourself. So anyway, I would go on this regime where I wouldn't speak. So my mom, she loved to talk. And so I said, Mom, I have to cut off now. And then she made the statement. She said, you are so eccentric these days. She used to not have an access.
What time of afternoon or evening did you cut off?
Oh, about 10 o'clock at night. I was not.
Oh, no, no.
Oh, no.
I thought
that was
been
it. No, no. And then the whole next day until I went to the performance.
Okay. And you wouldn't use your voice
at
all.
And Leontine was even more than me. I heard she would go weeks and she wouldn't. She would entertain people. She had to, because she was really, people were really judging her.
Who's that?
Leontine Price.
Okay.
So she had a much harder regiment than me.
Mm-hmm. So then, Describe an operatic voice. Mm-hmm. It obviously has to be a soprano, a really strong...
Strong. It has to be strong because you're singing over 120 instruments, playing at the loudest, and you're singing in a big halls where 3,000 and 4,000 people, and so you're having to really have a huge sound. Yeah, pop singers and jazz singers, they're all singing with the mics mm-hmm. in their throat. We have no such thing. So if I'm singing, which I'm starting now, it's light jazz, so I would sing with a mic, and I would sing, and when October goes, the world begins to shine. I'll do like that. Now, if I'm singing opera, I'll go, just mm-hmm. a moment, microphone. Mm-hmm. I'll go, your son, Lumen, see the decibels of sound? It's just night and day.
You just gave me goosebumps.
Oh, really? But it's night and day. So it's a big production, and I liken it to swimmers, or you have to really be strong in your body to support that kind of sound.
So did you work out at all?
No, they do now. The singers do now. But mm-hmm. we have certain physical exercises we do with our diaphragms and things. But I think you have to come with that kind of voice to kind of, you know, you're either born with that kind of voice or you're not.
The strength.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But do you sing now?
I still sing opera a little bit? Yes, because right. I do some concerts. Matter of fact, I'm going in April. I'm essaying half opera, half jazz.
Oh, where is that going to be?
It's going to be at the Opera America Hall in New York City, in Manhattan.
Oh.
And so it's going to be a new, different thing for people to hear me. So do both.
You got to, and the first half,
jazz? The first half would be jazz and Broadway. A little bit, I could have danced all night kind of thingy. And then the second half is total in this lower voice. That other soprano, this is contralto tenor.
Because your voice?
Because that's what it's natural for me and comfortable. And actually, when I did gospel when I was a child, that was my natural voice.
So has your voice changed since now?
Well, I think as you get older, it maybe mellows and get a little bit thicker and like that too. Yeah, yes, I do think that. But personally, saying that, opera singers generally, they don't sing after a certain point, sopranos, because their voices do get mm-hmm. lower, and they can't always reach those higher notes. So I was kind of different, because Collis and Tabaldi, they were all not singing after 35, but I was just getting started.